I was toting my pack along the windy Conshohocken Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load.
I feel like it's like some sort of like highly structured exercise I planned out. Welcome to Barnstorming PA. We've got a really interesting episode today. This is the second part of our own pandemic plus a year. And today we're going to try and look a little bit more at what the future may look like, which is always a dicey endeavor. I'm really excited today to have several of our returning people and a new person, Aaron Tracy, who you will hear from in a moment. So I'm going to ask people to say hi and introduce themselves. And today we're going to all share something. We were talking about this beforehand, something a little bit quirky or interesting from our own medical history, since we're talking about medical things. We'll see where that goes. But as I said, I'm Jordy Comas. I'm one of the co-producers of Barnstorming PA. I'm also a facilitator for the Hub for Progress. I'm also on the board for UU Justice PA here in Pennsylvania. And my father, actually, who's a physician, once told me I was a medical oddity, which was very much on brand for his sense of humor. But I'll go with this one. I was born anoxic with the umbilical cord around my neck, and it caused some issues in my muscle development. So I actually have a mild form of what is it called when you're a palsy in my legs. And when I was five, I was walking on my tiptoes all the time, and I was in danger of not being able to walk. And my brother, who's 11 years older, was the only one who was saying he can't help it, because all the stupid doctors were like, he'll grow out of it. Just, you know, very moralist. It was like, you know, he's just being resistant. And it turns out my Achilles tendons weren't growing right, and they had to have a surgery to correct it. So, but if you TMI, but if you watch me walk, I walk on the balls of my feet, and physical therapists are always trying to get me to heel strike, and I literally can't do it.
So it's interesting.
Yeah. Is it?
Yeah. It does affect your gait and mm-hmm. your posture. So yes. Actually you have a very different visual presence, which yes. We haven't seen you in years.
Yes, year, exactly. Well, yeah. It's 1 year, 10 years. Yes. So Sam, why don't you go next?
So I'm Sam Pearson. I am also a Hub facilitator. I am involved with various racial justice things. And this year have been, especially for this episode, I have been talking about, reading about, and telling other people about all things COVID. And my medical history oddity would be, well, I also had I had tibular torsion. So I was born with my both feet totally turned in.
Oh my gosh.
Had casts first on both legs for like, 4 months, and then on one leg because they screwed one up. And so I learned how to walk three times. I learned how to walk after they took the cast off. Then they put a cast on one leg. I learned it again. And then they took the cast off and I flipped myself over trying to walk without a cast. And I had to learn again. So.
And I will say you learned very well, because you are the fastest fucking walker I have ever. Trying to walk with you is so hard.
Oh, wait. Guess what?
Ezra's faster.
Well, no, actually. But that there's actually been a research study recently that said that fast walkers are less likely to die of COVID.
You're outrunning the virus?
I don't know. It's like the weirdest study ever. I'm like
airflow.
Yeah.
We're all annoying. I mean, everyone hates a fast walker, but I am, yes, I am okay. A fast walker.
Aaron, you got to leave the mute off, because we like to capture the laughing. Okay. So anyway, let's throw it to Nathan next. I do want to, you know, Nathan, Nathan texted me and he said, I had a COVID positive test and I haven't been feeling well. And I said, I think that means you actually just had COVID. I think you're underselling. But, you know, hearts out to you. And, you know, we all hope you don't have any of the long haul symptoms.
Thanks. I don't have shortness of breath anymore, really, for the most part. Sometimes in the mornings, it's rougher than other days, but I don't know. It's just kind of a strange thing. Do not recommend, if you have the choice, probably avoid it. Get those
avoid
masks,
COVID.
Wear those masks. Yeah. Yeah. Just a slight recommendation. I haven't checked the CDC guidelines recently, but I think they're still recommending that you avoid and not, you know, jump into COVID baths.
So. Come on, man. You're doing your patriotic duty by getting us all to herd immunity faster.
That's true. That's what that's all Republicans wanted from the beginning. I should have gotten sick sooner. We could have all been, I don't know, drinking on the beach right now, or whatever it is people do when it's not a pandemic.
But seriously, did you, you know, what tipped it? I mean, did you have any of the really idiosyncratic really symptoms? Did you lose taste?
Yeah, I did. And smell too. It was just like nothing really felt separate to me. Everything was just bland except for the way that I was feeling, which was crap. Yeah, I don't know.
Can I just say just real quick, this is weird, but like the fact that COVID has got some very distinctive symptomatic, symptoms, I actually find relieving, because I often, you know, and most of us have children. And when you look at a disease, it's like nausea, fever, swelling. And I'm like, that's every single disease. Like every single disease is the same five symptoms: fever, nausea, swelling, dizziness. It's like, how in the hell would we know what's what? So at least with COVID, right? Silver lining, if you, yeah.
Well, somewhat. I mean, the problem is there's such a range. So there are people who definitely lose it. And that's where, like, just, okay, check the cinnamon. Got it. Mm-hmm. Probably don't have COVID today. You know, that's like one of the best checks. But you can also almost have no symptoms, including not having those, and still have COVID. So that's a little bit of a...
Right.
There's such a broad range of possible combinations of symptoms and possible absence of symptoms that actually adds to the...
Yeah.
Extra special confusion.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, Nathan, did you want to say more about what you're up to these days?
Oh, sure. So other than sleeping, I am I'm working on a mayoral campaign because I'm a political consultant in the Harrisburg area. And my medical oddity isn't going to be COVID, because that's actually sadly common.
Right.
That's not that odd right now. Especially with cases on the rise in Pennsylvania because of variants and people, I think, getting bolder because they say, oh, you know, there's a vaccine, that means we're all safe. It's like, no, you actually have to get it in order to get the benefits of it. But my oddity is, it's also a lesson. So, when I was younger, I went to the doctor because I had all these things appearing on my skin, these little circles. It was kind of scary. And it turns out that it was just ringworm, but, I found out that one of the ways you can get it is apparently by consuming cat poop. And I only think I know that because my doctor accused me of doing it. She asked, but it felt a lot like an accusation. Do you eat cat poop? And it's just, no, I don't. I don't.
How old were you?
9, 10, somewhere in there.
So okay.
And
you sure you weren't at the vet and they thought you were a dog?
Oh my gosh. I don't know where my mom brought me.
See, sometimes she might've been trying to save money.
Times were tight.
Yeah.
She could have just been confused.
Yeah.
Did they take your temperature and how? That'll really...
Oh, well, I mean, just like every other time I went to the doctor, right in the butt.
Okay. All right. Nathan, you have had a singular life experience.
Thank you.
And
odd that your doctor phrased it as a question to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you eat cat poop?
Yeah. I think she was trying to just avoid stigmatizing it in case I did eat cat poop.
Right.
Really, I don't know if that's a cultural thing.
Really good, really good bedpan side manner. Okay, and sort of a drum roll. You've heard his voice, the man, the legend, Aaron Troisi. Welcome to Barnstorming PA.
I am so happy to be here. So I am Aaron Troisi. I'm lead political organizer with SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania currently, but Pennsylvania born and bred and raised.
I think organized. Bloomsburg, right? The only town.
Around Bloomsburg, yes.
The only town in Pennsylvania. What an odd claim to fame.
Yeah, well, that is from where I hail. And I've done organizing sort of in places all across the state, primarily starting in labor organizing, working in sort of new organizing, so working with healthcare workers to form unions at their facilities, and then ended up traveling around the state, landing in Philly, doing a bunch of community organizing and political work there, and sort of settling back in Lewisburg, and being somewhat involved in the local community. So have some sort of done some work through the community with AMP and some connections to the hub and stuff. But honestly, my day job takes up a lot of time, not just a day job, pretty much all the time.
You mean being a parent to two toddlers?
Well, that too, right?
That day job. Oh, okay.
That's the night job. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's the 4:30 a.m. Bathroom runs job. But yeah, I've sort of settled into political organizing with the union. So come out of sort of labor community organizing, and the work I do primarily in politics is actually less working with directly with the campaigns. So I'm sort of like on the IE side of the wall, or, you know, less on the coordinated side. And so really working with healthcare workers to enhance their advocacy and, you know, in advocating for the policies that healthcare workers need in Pennsylvania. And that obviously becomes very electoral when it comes to the makeup of the legislature and mayors and governor and Senate and, you know, all the way from bottom all the way to the top. So end up doing a lot of direct sort of campaigning and political work, but always sort of with an eye on the more mass sort of mobilization and organizing of folks and their advocacy.
Okay, let's rewind that for a sec. Let's pretend like I don't know what IE is.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. But like for somebody who's interested in politics but doesn't know all of that kind of like what, when you say you're doing political work, like what does that mean in terms of like what you were saying? Like you're not working directly with campaigns, you're ..
Yeah. Yeah, good question. So, I just assume that your audience has this incredible political understanding. So,
listen, the seventh most listened to place is Woodstock, Illinois. We don't really know what that is. All the others are in Pennsylvania, but I think we're going to have a road trip to. I don't really know what's in Woodstock, but sure, our audience knows a lot about politics, but
honestly. Jordy's being really nice. He just wants you to explain it because he knows that I don't know what you're talking about. Okay, the audience knows, but I really need people to spoon feed things to me. Please, please, please.
So I think when people traditionally think of political organizing, they think of campaigning, right? Because that's the way that we as voters most often interface with political work in our communities, right? We hear from campaigns, we get letters in the mail, we get a ton of calls. We may volunteer to work on campaigns. So making calls or sending letters ourselves, right, to talk to voters. And what we're often talking to voters about is specific people, right, actual candidates that we're trying to get into position, elected into positions of power. And so when we're campaigning in that way to actually elect people into positions of power, there are campaign finance laws. And those campaign finance laws actually dictate to the candidates sort of the work that they can engage in and the sort of the parameters of that work and where the funding for those campaigns has to come from and be spent. And so that's where the idea of this wall comes in. So in political campaigns, there's a wall between the spending that the campaign has raised. So all the donations that candidate has received and is able to spend on their saying to voters, hey, you should vote for me. Right. There's also a lot of organizations that also work on those campaigns, including in my case, labor organizations like unions. And unions can't go and talk to all their members and say, you should vote for Governor Wolf or Joe Biden and do that sort of like express and direct advocacy. That is essentially a campaign contribution to that campaign. Right. And so it has to be sort of like tracked a little bit differently for the IRS purposes in terms of the funding and the campaign finance. Now, the reason that there's a wall is because organizations like unions are membership organizations, and we can talk to our members, express advocacy. We can do that. And it's not considered a direct contribution or a contribution to the candidate. So if the AARP or the NRA or unions are talking to their members and they're saying, you should vote for this candidate, they're allowed to do that. And they don't have to report any of the materials or the expenses or the costs or the staff costs of organizers talking to people about that to the IRS as a campaign contribution to the candidate, because they're protected behind this wall that allows membership organizations to do that. But otherwise, there are these independent expenditures. That's the other side of the wall. And that's where, you know, organizations do have to report any contribution, which includes, you know, talking to the general public about voting for a candidate.
So, Aaron, I think that was one of the, I didn't feel like you had to go that deep into it. And that was like, no, it's a fantastic explanation. You know, in my head, I was sort of thinking that like, that there's political work is sometimes about campaigns directly. And I thought maybe what you were gonna say was also, you know, there's all of the like wanting, you know, union members or anybody to just talk to government about what they should do, which is another complication, right? So for example, you know, I'm on the board for UU Justice PA, which is a faith-based advocacy group for Unitarians. There's nothing that stops churches from saying, from inviting a politician in and saying, or an elected official and saying, we want to talk to you about this issue. But because of the way we've built the system, a lot of them get very antsy because they think that they've crossed some sort of line about giving aid to a campaign. So we could do a whole nother podcast. I mean, I'll just kind of put this out there. Like everything you described so eloquently, as I understand it, was designed to protect democracy from the influence of money. Right. All of those rules. And I think it's a crock of shit because the other side just does whatever they want anyway.
Exactly.
So it's sort of like, you know, people say Democrats bring a knife to a gunfight. We're bringing rubber tools of order to a knife fight. That's my tweak on it. And
just on that point, Jordy. Yeah. And I totally agree. And I know this isn't the topic today, so.
Well, go for it. You know,
but totally. And, you know, we have state employees in our union, and around political advocacy, they're hatch acted, right? So they can participate in direct advocacy. So we're like hyper conscious of that, reporting, tracking, making sure that they're doing advocacy, not direct candidate work. And then Pompeo is there at a campaign rally for Trump on our taxpayers' dime. Like, they don't care. We are like crossing every T, dotting every I, like, you know, defending against the
pile on, Sam. Go for it.
I was looking into the Hatch Act recently, and you know, people are like, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. I looked at it like, you can do it on your own time. You know, you just can't wear the gear, you know, while you're on the clock, and it does not actually muzzle you entirely. But a lot of people consider it as sort of, they're just ultra cautious. They don't want to be called out. And so it winds up muzzling the people who care what other people think completely, whereas it has zero effect on the people who don't care.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I was going to say, in my mind, and of course, Citizens United is this, you know, huge change to the landscape because it also freed up corporations to spend, you know, huge amounts of money, including little corporations like Barnstorming PA LLC. you know, in my mind, like the quick and dirty fix is like, look, just let's just start over, right? Like, everybody spend and do whatever the hell you want, because that's what they're doing anyway. And at least we'd be freer to do, you know, to organize the way we want. And the one caveat I have is like good public financing. And if you opt out, right, if you're running against somebody at any level down to county commissioner, if they opt out of the financing system and they go with private donations, then you get an exact match. Right. So like, it, you know, to me, that's the way, because rather than trying to have this incredible, because all it does is enrich accountants and lawyers. And so it's an incredibly complicated set of rules about who gets to spend money on this or that, which also just kind of rubs my First Amendment side the wrong way. I'm like, but what happened to assembly and petition? Like, you know, we've created all of these, you know, the Second Amendment people are like, look, you know, once we go down this path, we're going to lose the Second Amendment. Like, we've sort of lost the right to petition and organize. You know, I can't go to a Walmart parking lot and talk to people because of private property and all of that. Like, what's the point of the First Amendment if you can't use it? Anyway, we're not talking about that today.
Well, but then we could talk about the laws of enclosure in England and, you know, when like where you can walk and like, let's go.
Fun. Even like what our fundamental rights are. I mean, the fact that we protect freedom of speech and property,
yeah,
rights,
yeah,
and stuff is like, you know, that's an interesting way of approaching it, frankly, but. What,
yeah,
about the right to healthcare, right?
Wait,
to a job, meaningful work?
You don't have those rights, Aaron.
Not in America.
We do a lot of lip service, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, but does that actually even have any legal standing? I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. It's lip service.
Oh. I'm avoiding a bad joke about lip service. But
jumping back quickly, Jordy,
yeah, please.
That was a very long introduction, but the very sort of esoteric piece of where, the way I introduced myself was was essentially to say, I actually don't do a ton of direct campaigning, but when I do, it's sort of on the focus on our membership and talking to our union members about that.
But I don't
bulk of what I do. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. Well, okay, I don't do a lot of political campaigning, but when I do, it's very, very sexy.
Yeah, that's about right. The bulk of what I do is that sort of what you hit on a moment ago, Jordy, which is advocacy, which is like working with healthcare workers on policy changes at the local, state, or federal level.
So just because, you know, Aaron, I'm trying to use people's names more. I've been told I need to do that since we're an auditory medium. So Aaron, why healthcare union? I mean, was there a point at which you were interested in other unions? Do you have a tie to healthcare workers directly?
So no, I've actually never been a healthcare worker, which when healthcare workers hear that, are a little surprised and a little upset somewhat, because, you know, I am obviously a staff member in an organization that is really focused on healthcare work and important, you know, that folks who are representing organizations have a direct understanding of the work that's going on. No, I actually started with SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania, actually, because when I graduated college from Penn State back in the day.
Number one party school.
What's that?
Number one party school in America.
We are number one party school, apparently. No, I just heard that it was a very democratic union. And when I started with the organization, I was working on organizing not yet union nurses and healthcare workers, primarily at hospitals. And my experience with the union has been exactly that, which is like, it's an incredibly democratic union. Not all unions are, frankly.
Fraternal Order of Police. You know,
well, I don't know if they qualify. I mean, they're in an entirely different sort of fascist category.
They are a union, aren't they?
Not in the way that I would generally define a union, but.
Oh, all right. Well, that, anyway.
Contracts.
But when you're saying, democratic, you do mean small d democratic, right? Like you feel empowered as a person.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, our organization is really run by our executive board, which is all healthcare workers across the state. You know, they decide what my wages are and benefits, you know, like they really are sort of like my boss is like nursing home, hospital, and home care workers across the state. And I think we've had some pretty powerful sort of cultural history within the union, which is, you know, there's language in our bylaws that mean the president of the organization can't make above a certain threshold above our median income of our membership, which is not the case generally in the labor movement. I mean, I took a $10,000 pay cut to come back to this union because I believe in the leadership. And like, that's pretty common. I mean, if I was doing this work at a lot of other organizations.
How do you live on a negative income?
I didn't get the negative. It didn't go that far. It didn't go that far.
I just spent 10,000, zero minus 10,000. That's usually the way it works.
Yeah, so I think the organization is really powerful, and we are the largest healthcare union in the state and the largest nurses union. You know, nurses are the largest job class in Pennsylvania. They actually outpace teachers these days. And
I also think they outpace fracking workers, which is one of my things I like to lean into. How much political discourse in our campaigns is about fracking versus nurses relative to which job category is actually numerically and economically significant, huh?
For that matter, I mean, even though this is SEIU healthcare, like service employees are like, you know, the S and the E from SEIU. So if you look at the service industry in Pennsylvania, like the people who you know, ring up your stuff, like those people way outnumber anything that you could even hope for from fracking. So yeah, I'm definitely on that train, especially because a lot of those jobs are temporary. And if we were doing like green energy development, like a lot of those same people would have jobs when you're looking at like pipe fitters and stuff. And as the unions are recognizing that too, they're like, oh, hey, maybe we can actually have these changes and still have, you know, high quality jobs.
However, if you're a hydraulic fracking operator, we like you too. We understand you need to feed your family.
We just want you to do something different. I think that there are a lot of transferable skills.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Aaron. I'm actually curious. Are medical students and residents part of SEIU?
So there is a local, there is an SEIU local that represents medical students and residents, CIR,
okay.
Community of Interns and Residents, but not a whole lot in Pennsylvania. They're primarily in more urban centers, like
yeah.
Big chapter in New York and on the West Coast.
My brother was, he's a physician, and when he was a med student and resident, I feel like it was it in Baltimore and then in Miami? He was a union poster child, and they were trying to get, you know, better protections for reasonable. They already have unreasonable working hours by definition, but they had to have slightly more reasonable working hours. Like you could only be on for, you know, whatever it was, 36 hours straight, and you had to be able to sleep at least four of those or something like that, but not contiguous. I don't even remember. It was really bad. I was like, that's good.
That's an improvement.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I think it's an organizing model. I think is similar to graduate students, right? Because there is like this built-in attrition. You have essentially an entirely new membership every 4 years or 8 years, right? So yeah, I think it's really interesting. We experience that a bit in healthcare because turnover is so high. I mean, mm-hmm. every year about a third of our membership is like entirely new to the union.
In SEIU healthcare, not the other.
In healthcare. Parts. Yeah.
That's not nurses necessarily. That's probably like other kinds of healthcare workers, right?
It's nurses too. Yeah. Wow. There's a ton of nurses, particularly this last year.
Right.
At the bedside.
Well, Aaron, we're not going to let you off the hook, and maybe you got it in your foot, but what's your medical history?
Yeah. So I guess I'm a boringly typical medical history generally, but I did spend some time hiking around East Africa a number of years ago and ended up in...
Is that hiking or very lost?
Oh, no. We were hiking. We had okay. We had some good friends showing us the way. But we ended up in Zanzibar, which is right there in the Indian Ocean. And we stayed at a small beach called Jambiani, which is like on the Indian Ocean coast. And I noticed this odd thing in my toe one day and didn't quite know what it was, didn't quite think about it, just went on with my day. Was walking barefoot everywhere, of course, and ended up going to a friend of ours' place on the beach there. And as we were sitting there talking with his family, his daughter was sort of in the sand playing with my toe and found that spot and pointed it out to her father. And he was like, oh yeah, I got to get that out for you. I was like, I have no idea what's happening. I didn't speak Swahili super well. And he grabbed a long acacia thorn, like from the mm-hmm. Yellow barked acacia trees, and just started digging at it. And he slowly worked this worm out of my toe. I had no idea. I was watching him, my mouth agape, right? And I was so grateful immediately. I was just like, oh, thank you so much. It was just a wild and interesting experience. So
yeah, I think probably humans, right? Like the thought of something growing in you. Sorry, Sam. yeah. It's really
nightmares.
It's not a female. It's not reference to pregnancy.
Sorry. Thank you, Sam.
Currently had, I've had a bug enter. Yeah. Issue and have some, a weird bump on my arm.
And I was teasing her about the urban myth about a spider egg. Yeah, Sam, I didn't mean humans reproducing. I meant parasites.
It was funny because even I had the context and I still took it as a pregnancy comment. And I was just trying to wrap my head around it. What?
Jordy really is an asshole. They were right?
This is why we have a zero tolerance policy.
That's exactly. Right. That's right. Okay.
Okay, wait. Yeah. I want to add another medical history thing, partly because I can't help it because Jordy has the background, which is the library in Stockholm, mm-hmm. The Gunnar Asplund's library. And so that reminds me, I also stepped on a nail in Scandinavia while I was backpacking, hiking around, and wound up having gangrene and having surgery in Germany. So also foot things. I still feel like, but I'm getting the embedded animal out of my brain.
How was that that experience? Like going through to get a surgery in Germany?
Well, first of all, I had to get, I mean, there's a whole story, like a whole podcast on the actual, like getting from, it was actually Bergen, Norway, with the nail in the middle of the street. Yeah, whatever. Several hospitals, tetanus shots, band-aids from random people. And then getting crutches, obtaining crutches from the Norwegian government because I knew someone's birthday. And then getting myself by train with a pack to Germany on crutches. That was excellent. And then, so then I had a week in the hospital in Germany, which was good for my learning German, which was my plan anyway. And then I had recuperation in Germany, which was very good for my German. Maybe not as good for my biology, though, because it involved getting regular x-rays and going to this doctor who, like, this is the 90s, and he must have been, like, he could have been SS or something. I don't know. But he would, like, run x-rays in one room, and there were, like, no protections.
Ooh.
Like, anyway, it was very weird. Ooh. And ultimately, this culminated with me translating all of my medical bills from German into English so that we could get reimbursed.
Every single podcast, I'm like, I'm not going to let Sam or Taylor bring up German. And you always somehow squeeze it in. Yeah. No, actually, my daughter Thea pointed out to me yesterday, I guess this is what the Google Translate machine said, that the word for birth control pill in German is anti-baby pillen.
Yeah. Yeah, but it looks like die because it's D-I-E. So it's D, it's pronounced D, right? But it's die anti-baby pill.
Oh.
Like in English.
That's even better. Yeah. Oh, so you're another German speaker, Nathan. What about you, Aaron?
I am not. I just got a couple of things.
Okay. All right. Well, just a couple of housekeeping notes for our audience. We're always interested in feedback, please. We've been putting things on YouTube, so subscribe there. I've noticed that the term of art is smash the subscribe button. I don't know why the more like with it YouTubers always say smash the subscribe button, but that does help. You know, please rate or review on any platform you're on, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any of the multiple Android platforms. You can always reach us at info@barnstormingpa.org. That's all together, barnstormingpa. We're especially interested. I think we're going to kind of try and put together some focus groups, something like that. So if you've listened once or twice or to the whole catalog of 120 episodes, and in that case, you're not my mother, we'd love to talk to you and hear what you like about the show. We've got a lot of things in the pipeline that are coming out.
You can give stuff. Feedback if you haven't listened to every show.
Yeah, did I not say that?
Yeah, well, that seemed okay. A little clear. Yeah.
The way that you said it, it wasn't clear if you meant if you've listened to one episode, two episodes, or if you meant that you've listened to the entire catalog once or twice. There was
some
ambiguity there. So if you've heard every episode twice, I am sorry.
Oh, thank you. I have because I edit them, but
I'm sorry.
And it gets weird sometimes because I'm like really tired of hearing my own voice. And my children don't believe that. I said that the other day and they threw some Rotten Tomatoes at me. They're like, you love the sound of your own voice. To clarify, whether you've listened to one, two, the whole catalog, once, twice, many times, whoever you are, if you'd like to help us think through how to, you know, what's good about the show and how to improve it, please reach out. So in that very on-brand artisanal way, we're going to shift to more of our main topic now. And I think a useful thing to start with that I think I borrowed from Dwayne Heiser, who's often on, and I'll ask Aaron, ask maybe you to go first, is if we think about this pandemic and where we are there some things for you, you know, either in your work life or your personal life or just, you know, thinking about being part of, you know, our society and the world, like what has changed that shouldn't go back? Right. Is that a useful thing to think about and to kind of maybe surface issues that are there, but we don't always think about or talk about because we're focused on vaccine numbers but do you want to take a crack at that, Aaron, please?
Yeah. And I'll sort of respond from a bit of a narrow perspective on the work that I do around sort of issues advocacy with healthcare workers. But I think hopefully it'll be a bit of a jumping off point for other ideas. But I think one thing over the past year that we've really noticed in our work across the state is we have more engagement than like ever before. We have more engagement in our union. We have more engagement in contract negotiations. We have more engagement in lobbying, right? And we have more legislators who are more easily able to connect with our members and more members who are showing up and taking action than like ever before, right? And part of that is these are healthcare workers and we're in a pandemic, right? We're in the largest public health crisis of certainly our lifetimes so far. And over the, you know, since the last century, right? And so part of that is, you know, these are essential frontline workers who are day in, day out, taking care of people on the front lines of the pandemic. And so they're stepping up to take action, right? I think the other part of it is that the remote element of it, right? Is that I do think the remote, you know, Zoom and the ability for people to participate, the bar is a lot lower. Because they can participate from home. We have, you know, members who you know, get out of work and hop on Zoom in their phones, right? It's like, it's just an immediately easy way to sort of get plugged in. What we have also seen, though, is that it has been a lot harder to do meaningful leadership development. So we have, so in some ways that, you know, I think that's like, I think that's what's going to continue, is that like the remote capacity and collective understanding of how to participate in that way, I think will continue to sort of like increase our mobilization efforts. Like, it's good for mobilizing. In some ways, though, it's actually harder for more long-term and deeper organizing, because without that sort of in-person connections, relationships, collective struggle, and the hard work that it takes to really coordinate and put those things together, without you know, workers or community members really getting to experience that and get the direct sort of support from and experience from folks who are engaged in that, that's like what we've seen over this year, and what I expect to continue is that we're going to use these tools to increase mobilization, and that's going to be fantastic and engage more folks across the state. But I think the sort of deeper organizing, deeper leadership development, and real organizing skills that build lasting change, that's been harder this year. And I think that will continue to be a challenge.
Real quick, Sam, so more opportunities, but maybe harder to realize them down the road.
The way I would think about it is, and maybe this is like a weird way of describing it, but I think it's broader, but shallower capacity, right? Versus like narrower but much deeper capacity.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're building the base, but you're not getting enough new pinnacles, right, of leadership. You need exactly. to sort of have a proliferation of leaders that's proportional to the base. I actually think that is tied to the technology. And we have endless conversations literally about you know, what tech is better and what it does. But I think actually we're sort of in the weeds of the specifics of one application or another, but we are not thinking about, you know, the Brady Bunch view and how that is both democratic and stultifying, right? We're sort of constrained and everyone is an equal size box, or, you know, worse, people are on phones, like you said, and they can't even see all the boxes. So many people are just connecting by phone. In fact, a lot of people were finding they were mainly connecting on a computer at work or through work, and now they only have some kind of mobile device access most of the time. So it's hard to have documents that share large amounts of information, you know, at high density levels. It's hard, you know, you can only convey what can be conveyed orally in the amount of time that you have with large groups of people actually live speaking, you know, and some people can't access the chats. You can't really put, and some people can't access links. And it's a weird asymmetrical communication space. And it's also like there's no hierarchy to the virtual space. And so we also talk about breakout rooms and programs that will allow you to sort of move and gather in different ways. But even just for one event is not adequate. We actually are stuck in Zoom, being sort of stultified by Zoom on a daily basis.
Well, all technologies enable and constrain. I think you probably agree with that, Sam. So, on the, you yep. know,
yeah.
Zoom, Zoom is also, it gives us the broader, more shallow, if you go with that.
Exactly. I mean, this is my favorite. Like I was writing screeds about like the mouse as an input device, you know, 25 years ago, like just so mad at what it was doing to architecture and drawing. It's like, we have gone from, you know, actually being able to draw to like using our fists to try to create buildings. And we're looking at it on these teeny little screens. It's like looking through a toilet paper tube at a building.
I'm picturing screed-filled younger Sam raging against the tyranny of the mouse. That's,
oh yeah,
delightful.
Also on ground.
Yes, it is.
Nathan, do you have something, you know, something coming to your mind about like what, you know, from your professional or personal life about what's changed that won't go back or shouldn't?
It's so many things. I think some of it is just cultural. I like, it's weird because the first thing I actually thought about was something that's already kind of fallen to the wayside, but there was a period of time where every Republican's top issue was suicide prevention. And it's because they had this data that that because people aren't good with statistics, it was like really blown out of proportion that the suicide rate and some other things were going way up during the pandemic, which there were rises, and of course every one of those is tragic. But this idea that that like the only way to address that issue was going to be to like open things up so that people could die from a virus instead of dying from, you know, committing suicide or killing oneself. It's like, I don't know. I liked that there was a period of time when mental health seemed to really be an issue that was bipartisan and everybody was caring about it. I thought that it was going to open up. I naively thought that it was going to open up into a broader conversation about just like mental health and how it's real health and how people maybe should be entitled to that as well if we want to fix some of the ills of the world. Because I mean, as much as our bodies are important, our minds decide what they do. So I think that I can't overemphasize that.
I mean, yes, like, go ahead.
Like the pacing that's changed because of it. So I like that people are a lot more generous with their patients, generally speaking, the people who are in my circles, at least.
Thank you, Nathan. Sam?
Can I just do mine and piggyback on Nathan's?
I mean, you can do whatever you want.
Okay, but I'm interrupting you. I just wanted to say we should link to, there's one particular incident that highlights exactly what he's talking about. And there were articles about it where Redfield, who was the director of CDC, you know, cited some statistic about levels of suicide among high school age population and levels of coronavirus death. And it was, like Nathan said, such a misunderstanding of the statistics and levels of risk and things like that. And it was then weaponized. Redfield was just like a walking nightmare in terms of messaging. And so my takeaway is actually, I want us to move forward with listening to people who know things and paying attention to public health messaging. I can't say though that we've done it. Like some of us have done it, and some of it has also been like lessons in how difficult it is to get the messaging right. In fact, we are right now in the middle of a messaging disaster, and yet another messaging disaster with respect to vaccination. And so many people, including the vaccinated, thinking they are free and clear and not understanding that even if you're vaccinated, especially with the amount of community spread and the variants, you could still be a threat and threatened by others. So a threat to or threatened by others. So that is not getting across. And there was an argument about this. 2 months ago, people were saying, well, we have to promise them that they get something better when they get their vaccine or they're not going to bother. But now we're dealing with consequences, basically.
Yeah. Thank you, Sam. So, keeping some of those things in mind, I think that kind of sets us up for kind of a pivot. For the audience, so that you know, I'm not an expert in scenario planning and scenario building as a strategic exercise. I've done it a little bit and I've seen it done, but I find it really potentially really valuable. And the core idea is this, and from some of what I know, it emerged or maybe was pioneered in the 70s by Royal Dutch Shell when they were facing the, they're an oil exploration company, and they were looking at the what was going on with OPEC and different shocks to the oil economy, and just trying to get around, like, how do we think about the future, but not just using quantitative models? How do we think about like the interaction of several kinds of dynamic factors? And so out of that, and if you follow a methodology, you can end up with scenarios, you know, 1, 2, 3, up to as many as you want. You know, I know that I couldn't even begin to explain Bayesian statistics, but like, you know, there are ways that people try and model this very quantitatively. And I'm all about trying to use that. But I think there's something to be said for like letting the parts of our brains that are very good at pattern recognition and understanding that kind of dynamic complexity, like leaning into it in that way. So what we're going to do here is not even a scenario, but, you know, as a group, and we've got our own sets of expertise, we're by no means like the fullest set we'd want, but we're going to kind of talk through, if we were to try and project forward, what might be different scenarios that we would see? What are some of those factors that would matter? And we'll just kind of do, and maybe we'll continue it down the road, but, you know, I think it's really a valuable exercise, because it's not just thinking about like, okay, well, are there going to be variants? Is the vaccine robust? But then you start to think like, you know, this is something where my mind's been, but what happens with vaccines and vaccine technology when you add into it the economic structure of the pharmaceutical industry, or the willingness of the political system to pay for these things? So that's kind of the setup. Does that make sense to Aaron, Sam, Nathan? You all muted yourselves. I told you not to.
Good. It sounds like it makes sense, but I'm curious, is the intention, like, is the purpose behind what we're doing trying to like get at root causes of things?
The purpose is to sell ads, Nathan.
Oh, what's this episode brought to us by? Inference.
But Moderna, I'm going to Moderna. No, the purpose. Yeah, it's a good question. The purpose is, if we were gonna go further, which we probably don't have time to, but if we wanted to actually write a scenario, what are the dimensions we'd want to look at? You know, what are the things that we'd want to say? If you imagine it like sliders or continua, you know, which are the things that could change that matter and that will interact with other dimensions? So we just want a beginning list of those. It's a very modest goal. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I'll just kind of say this, not that we have to start with these, and you all may want to sort of bring up others, but this is maybe for the benefit of the audience too. Here are some that I came up with, and I'm not even going to say the questions, but just sort of, I think I had 10 or 11 that seemed to me they might be relevant. You know, vaccines and robustness to variants. Are you making fun of me, Sam?
That's a lot.
11.
Go ahead.
You don't think I should? Well, I already.
It's fine. No, go for it.
So, vaccines and robustness to variants. I'm going to really lean into variants because I use the word variants a lot. So, or I need to say heterogeneity instead of variants. What are the characteristics of different variants of corona? The U.S. political context. That's number three. Number four, pharmaceutical industry and its economics. I realize now that I put too many. I may skip over some of these. What about the healthcare workforce overall? Let's see. What about public health communications strategies and tactics? Globalization will, you know, one aspect of this is, if we see a resurgence of a globally integrated economy, what does that mean? Another aspect of globalization, what about nationalism and sovereignty? And the last one, I was thinking about a sort of oppression and discrimination and the way that interacts with politics. So, you know, I'll just kind of throw out, like, I'm sort of imagining with variants of COVID, you know, what happens if some populations, either in the US or in other places, have a more virulent variant or more dangerous variant, and they're trying to, you know, they're a refugee population. Like, you know, imagine that there's a variant at the border. What is that like? So, having thrown out a huge buffet, right, and you've got a tray, here's the metaphor, Nathan, and you've got one of those school trays, you know, that's got like seven pockets where you can put some food. Which one do you want to serve up first?
Well, I don't know if, what was the second thing that you read? Cause I kind of missed that one. It was just the second thing on the list.
I think it was the characteristics of the different variants.
So
for example, and maybe Sam can say, or I don't know, and I don't know how much what you do means that you have to know about some of the science, but you know, there's the basic, you know, how virulent is it? But then there's also, you know, what are the health impacts?
What are the health? So there's virulence, there's health impacts, there's the profile, like whether they, you know, how long it's asymptomatic, mm-hmm. or how long you're, when you become contagious. Is it normal, like when you have symptoms, or is it prior to symptoms, which is right. we've discovered everything.
Right. And we were also all educated on some terminology too, with like R0 for the reproduction rate and things like that. So if we're looking for metrics, like I guess that's just a grouping, right? All of the
yes.
virulence.
Yeah. And R0 and also K value, which is like the degree to which the R's are homogenous or very uneven.
Right. Right.
Wait a sec. So the K value is different R's of a population or of a
it's vaccine, like the range the virus. Of the it's the range of the R. So I mean I'm butchering that, but it's basically you can have an R value if it's an average of a whole bunch of things that are sort of everyone transmits to three people, you know, your R value might be 3. But what if you're one person transmits to 70 people and ever, you know, 20 people.
Gotcha. So for people we want this. So R is about how much it spreads, and Sam, what you're saying is, okay, so you know, a virus in a population, it could spread such that each person has a fairly similar amount of ability to spread it, or some people may be super spreaders. And that's what you're talking about with K values, correct?
Yes. Yes. And currently we have high K values.
Mm-hmm. I did teach statistics once.
Okay.
Yeah, I hadn't sort of thought about that. Do we know why there are different K values? Is it biological or sociological?
Could be anything, you know, that
or both.
Right. We're going to know a lot more later, right? Like, we're studying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like with most things, I think it's definitely a combination of both though. And I don't know if this was on the list, but like, I think just equity as something that we're measuring, or if that can be a knob and we can like turn it up a little bit, that would be great. Like
we would love to turn up the equity knob. I mean, that's why we do this, Nathan, right?
Right, exactly. So in Harrisburg right now, you have it to where white people are receiving the vaccine at over 3 times the rate of the BIPOC population in the city, which is pretty ridiculous since Black people alone are 51% of Harrisburg, but they're getting it at 1/4 the rate of white people, which means that you're just asking for the city never to have any type of immunity in the community. Immunity in the community. That's poetic.
Well, I mean, that actually kind of, you know, I think that's interesting is because like you're talking about the equity knob, I would love to turn it up, but do we actually think that there's any reason why that fundamental inequity would not play out in any of these scenarios? You see what I'm saying? Like from like a scenario building perspective, in my mind, it's like, is there any reason to think that we would have a more equitable distribution?
Well, there is a state vaccine equity task force that has been working. And in fact, like right now, there's a lot of angst about whether we're still in 1A, phase 1A for vaccine distribution or not. And in fact, locally, so 1A is people over 65 and people 16 to 64 who have a very specific list of health concerns, also medical providers and people associated with medical providers, long-term care facilities, et cetera. So it's sort of high vulnerability and high proximity to COVID people. What we know, there's been a big push recently, and it's good to get K through 12 teachers vaccinated. They are 1B and they did not get added to 1A, and it's not all educators. It was just K through 12. And so the push was anyone who was in that category who had not already gotten their vaccine for other reasons, because of their age or illnesses, could then get it through the IUs, the intermediate units around the state or districts directly. So that...
Real quick, so people may not know this outside of Pennsylvania, intermediate units is a way for smaller school districts to pool resources to do things that no one school district can afford to do.
Right. They're sort of like meta admin shared infrastructure. So what this means, though, is there's massive amounts of confusion over whether all teachers, not just K through 12, and it's also not just teachers, it's school employees, like K through 12 school employees, bus drivers, food workers, administrators, everything. But it's not, for example, higher ed. But in the Lewisburg area, there's a lot of people from Bucknell getting vaccinated right now, and they are managing to do this. And there's a lot of people hot under the collar about whether they should or should not be doing so. And
so Sam, to go back to where we were though, like what you're saying is there are sets of, there are ways that institutions and rulemakers could turn the knob on equity. We could have more equitable distribution. Like that is a thing and from a scenario perspective, we could have low equity or high equity.
Right. And then we also have to work in the cheaters.
But I'm not saying the outcomes, because Nathan was talking about metrics. And I think this is an important thing. Before we would know the metrics, Nathan, we would say, well, at least in Pennsylvania compared to, I'm just going to pick another state. Oh, I don't know, Florida, where, in Pennsylvania, there's a system to try and have more equitable distribution in Florida less. And then, from this perspective, if we think about what does that mean, right, then we can kind of start to map it out. But Aaron, did you want to, go another direction, add on to this, whatever you want. This is a very wide open.
Just listening to this, it's like, I think the vaccine rollout in Pennsylvania has been really, really bad, frankly. And hopefully Secretary Beam is not going to listen to this podcast, because we're on with our Nurse Advisory Council with the Department of Health later today, to talk about this. So I got to be a little conscious of what I say, depending on who's in your listenership. But my sense is that, can we do better? Absolutely, we can always do better. And are there structures that will allow us to do that? Absolutely, there's no question. I think the question is what we do now. I really do think that we are like at a crossroads, this month, last month, next month, like coming up. And the good news is, we got the White House, we got the Senate, right? We got the House, and we're making moves. I mean, $7.3 billion is coming to Pennsylvania soon. A bunch of that is earmarked for vaccine distribution. So the question is, can we do better? In my mind, that's not a question. We can definitely do better. Where that sort of butts up with reality.
But Aaron, is better faster or more equitable? I mean, how are you defining
both,
better?
Both. Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, I think the... I feel like there's a lot of cultural issues. In Pennsylvania, when the vaccine sort of began to be rolled out, 60% of nursing home workers refused to take it. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of different reasons for that, frankly. And there are reasons on the left and there are reasons on the right, right? Which is like partly what confounds the entire issue, right? So there's all the Trumpers who follow the Republican sense that everybody should just get sick. A bunch of people are going to die, but it's better to have businesses open. And then there's a bunch of folks on the left, hardworking, people of color who have a lived experience of institutional racism and the reality that our community has always been on the guinea pigs for new technologies. And so we've done a lot of work around vaccine education with healthcare workers, right? But it's really challenging, and it's challenging because the cultural objections are very real, and they're not as easy. It's not as easy as someone on the left or in the progressive community just to say, well, just go get vaccinated. That is insufficient. And so I really think we can do better across the board, both in terms of the timeline. And now that we're getting some stimulus, some capacity to add to that. But I also think we need to do better in terms of helping the everyone, right? The population sort of think through what is appropriate for our community. And that has to be culturally appropriate.
Well, and this is challenging. I mean, basically, I agree that everything is mismanaged, but I also don't see a lot of other states that are doing a whole lot better, especially not with the mix of population we have, right? So West Virginia definitely did better for rural, isolated white people. And that could be a good model for us in parts of our state, which is sort of the local providers, local pharmacies.
Do you know why they Do you know why they did better?
Because they didn't have the large scale distributors. It was supposed to be all CVS and Walgreens, and those didn't exist for most of the state. And the state was like, well, that's not going to work for us. We've got to come up with something else. And they were also, with these tiny, tiny communities, knew that they were dealing with people who needed a more personal relationship. The problem is, if we prioritize, it's hard to prioritize equity and speed. And at a certain level, speed is good for everyone.
Right? I was about to say, I've been wanting to say that. I was like, you know, I don't mean to be a jerk, but like, okay, if you go fast and it's unequal in the along the way, but at the end you get most of the people.
That could be good. The reality is that the system set up to go fast will basically be a white system. It'll be a white wealthy system. It will be and in fact, if we really wanted to go fast, we would just focus on Pittsburgh and Philly. How do you feel about that?
Right, exactly.
And it would be the suburbs, right? Like it would reinscribe everything that is wrong with everything about the United States. And so that's why we need to figure out a way to balance this. And we also need to address it in the way that Aaron is talking about. Even that, like trying to talk to people, there's a lot of, oh, well, you know, because of Tuskegee, you know, African-Americans don't want to get, you know, the Tuskegee Airmen experiments where men were infected with syphilis and left to suffer for a lifetime. Because of that, you know, African-Americans don't want to get the shots. And it's like, no, it's because their doctor yesterday and last year has been completely ignoring and maltreating and, you know, like.
Exactly. Thank you for saying that. Like, I know some of the research, but I'm like, I don't think, I'm just going to say this, maybe this is the zero tolerance policy. I don't think your average Black person is like, I don't know if I trust my doctor because it's Tuskegee. I think it's much more proximate issues, including sometimes maybe even just access.
Yep.
Right.
So
they may not have even seen a doctor yesterday.
Right. So we talk about intersectionality, although reading more about it recently, I'm thinking of it as collisionality. Ooh. You know, when you got hit by a car at the intersection of your Blackness and your whiteness and your femininity, was like, which car hit, you know, which direction was it coming from?
Sorry,
it
is was this a literal car or a metaphorical car?
The metaphorical car.
Okay, well, because there could be literal car, because we're talking about healthcare. So I'm sorry, right. I was like.
Right. But I'm just saying it's at the intersection, you know, talking about those intersections, it's not just standing there. It's like the acute moment, like, of the collision is the problem. Like there's many different dimensions to the problem in your daily life, but then at the moment of collision, you have no idea. And it's a very specific thing that's related to both and all, you know, all of the above, your sexuality, your lived experience, your race, and all of those things combine. And right now the pandemic is a massive collision with reality. And
No, that's okay. I'm just trying to
listen.
Well, no, not that. Yes, a little bit. But like going with the knobs and like, you know, let's imagine there's higher equitable distribution and lower equitable. And then, you know, Aaron, you were starting to talk about the political context. And I think, you know, we all know, and I looked at something yesterday that was like broke down the U.S. population by, sorry, let me finish my first thought. Like there's a 2x2 matrix, right? So there's more equitable. Like, what's the political piece? I mean, to me, the political dimension is will Republican influence makers, will Republican influence makers like come on board, right? Because hold on, I see you shaking your head. Hold on. and the reason that matters is, and I say influence makers because I don't want to say that it's politicians, it may be other people, but I was looking at a chart yesterday that Matt Hildreth, so shout out to him and the rural organizers. I'm not sure if they made it or he was sharing it, but it was like a breakdown of who says they'll get a vaccine when. And it was evangelical Christians and Republicans who were the most reluctant. And of course, there's a lot of overlap there, more and more so in the last 30 years, you know, Jimmy Carter, famous liberal evangelical. There aren't many of him anymore. But, you know, what's that about? And I'm pretty sympathetic to the idea that, like, they're waiting. It's not that they doubt vaccines as much as they're waiting for the authoritarian that they believe to tell them to take it. right? They're not making a rational choice about, I want my freedom. They want to, you know, they want an authoritarian society and they want the father figure to tell them what to do. Sam, we're going to disagree.
Yeah. I've been reading studies about this and the studies are saying not that. So Frank Luntz, a Republican mm-hmm. pollster who, you know, has been like messing with our brains for several decades. He actually is on the right side of this. Like he yes. is very interested in getting as many Republican, well, people in general vaccinated. And so he's been doing polling on this since November. He teamed up with the de Beaumont Foundation. And there's huge amounts of data and slide decks available for messaging. He thought, in what you're saying, he thought we just needed, you know, the former guy to come out and say everyone, all Republicans need to get vaccinated.
Okay, but in my defense, I said whoever the influence makers are, I'm not saying it's Trump.
Well,
it may be somebody else.
Yeah, they also tried it. He did a focus group and he's been doing polling and they tried it with various politicians and the Trumpsters were like, nope, do not have any politicians tell us anything about this. It's all been politicized. I don't want to hear. They wanted to only hear from a scientist that they still thought was nonpartisan. So definitely not Fauci. And they happened to go with Tom Frieden, who is a former CDC director, I believe under two different administrations.
So they want a scientist who passes their test of being partisan enough to seem nonpartisan to them because he agrees with what they already think.
Frieden doesn't necessarily, but they just didn't know.
But that's their metric.
I guess. Yeah.
I mean, it's a very tendentious criteria for legitimate medical advice. You can't be partisan if you disagree with me, which means you're nonpartisan. But the only way you could be that is if you agree with the partisan people I like.
But Frieden is not in that category. All but right. it's more that they're able to construct this narrative about him that he is okay, and that science is isolated and, you know, separate from political mm-hmm. reality.
I think we really need to just exhume somebody who used to have a very popular talk radio show, and maybe if he said it, I think that some people might buy into it. You know, I know it's a missed opportunity.
Listen, he's probably pretty well pickled given the chemicals he put into his body. We're talking about Rush Limbaugh, if anybody.
Right. We could just get him. It is, after all, the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah. So. But Sam, we keep trying to text you. I mean, what's Luntz's answer? It's not influence makers. It's what?
It's a message from from scientists. He has very specific things about, you know, they need to we just want the facts, which is also a mess because. These are the things they say they want, which is.
I'm not sure. I mean,
I'm
being clear. They're saying that they want facts that seem neutral, but they've already decided. Am I being clear? Like, it's a weird.
Yes. And I'm agreeing with you.
Okay. All right. I just want to make sure I'm being clear.
It is. So they are a very isolated group. Their reluctance is staying fairly steady, whereas African American vaccine hesitancy seems to be dropping, responding to some messaging. But those groups, and actually Hispanics, are also notable as potentially having issues with hesitancy, and also, of course, young people. So,
and honestly, for Spanish speaking people, it's not just hesitancy; it's also language access is a huge issue. A lot of these huge calls are not going out bilingually, or they're just not penetrating in Spanish speaking communities. I was at Planned Parenthood yesterday volunteering with a new person. And she's a student at the Penn State Hershey Medical Center, I guess. So she's doing residency right now, but she's been administering vaccines. And before she went to medical school, she was a Spanish and a psychology major. And she was specifically chosen to go to a site in the city that was supposed to target Spanish speaking people because their uptake of the vaccine has been so low. When we talk about fast being good for everybody, in some ways, equity is also good for everybody, just because if you're not reaching the most vulnerable people, we're fooling ourselves into thinking that we're reaching this immunity just because it's like, oh, if enough people get it, it's like, no, it actually has to be enough people in the right places as well.
Yep.
So equity is integral to protecting white people too, not just making sure that the people aren't white are getting access to something.
You're totally right. And Nathan, the other piece about this that I think I know we all know, but I don't feel like it's out there enough, is that equity is good for capitalism.
Right.
because, you know, this is this, we all need each other to be healthy so that we can buy our doodads and wee-hoos and whatever, so that mm-hmm. the markets keep working. So, having alienated all of my hardcore leftist audience. Aaron, actually I wasn't calling you, sorry. But well, like,
I did want to jump in here.
Sure, actually, go ahead.
But not to interrupt you, Jordy. But yeah, no, it's really interesting. My sense of the hesitancy on among Republicans to really get behind public health, which like seems so straightforward, is actually really tied to the general rejection of science on the right. Right? It's like the fact that we had to fight for 20 some how many years to get climate change a nationally recognized reality is like, right? Wait, I think it's all part of the same thing.
We did that? When did we do that? I missed that.
The willingness to take action on it.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, so it's also like, I think the strategic way of going about it, of actually moving the right in the right direction, is not to convince politicians that even their people want the vaccine, even their people are on board. Because, you know, the stimulus package, the ARP, the American Rescue Plan, is actually a great example of that, where it actually enjoyed majority support. It was very popular, including with Republicans, and it still didn't result in a single Republican voting for it. So I don't think that the answer is like, let's talk to Pennsylvania Republicans, get them to contact their Republican legislators and think that's going to change anything. I just don't think that's going to work.
I feel like I failed somewhere when I explained this. I never meant to say that politicians were the influence makers.
I know.
Okay.
But my thinking though, just along with that is like, then the solution is, I think in my mind, is to like, just like ram it down their throats, like just like get like forget the Republicans and do what we need to do and give the people what the people need. And in so doing, create the structures that I think when people get their $300 a month starting in July for each of their kids, Republican or not, they're going to want to continue that. And so I think it's like it's an organizing and political sort of advocacy model, I think has demonstrated success in the past. And I think it's what we need to, it's how we need to sort of approach it here, which is like, let's give the people what we need as much as we can. Let's figure out how to get, you know, that to American city, the American people. And sort of like challenge Republicans to take it away once we win.
Sam?
I just want to point out that we already have scenarios, Jordy. So we have a scenario in Harrisburg, we have a scenario where we need more targeted equity work, targeting African-American community, Hispanic community, trying to make sure that vaccine distribution is more equitable. We are actually already doing that to a certain extent up in Williamsport, but we also, in central Pennsylvania, we need targeted and long-term. Yes, we just need to rush, but rushing is going to leave all, we have too many people in the hesitant category in our area. We are going to have a lingering problem. So everyone else, I believe we can, within the next 2 or 3 months, deal with the, you know, we can reach people in tighter population centers where we have more infrastructure and where we can focus. Your question about who are the influence makers out here, like the Lycoming County commissioners have been asked by a community group that I'm working with, Let's End COVID, to do some fairly low level funding from their COVID funds to provide hard costs for billboards, basically public health messaging campaign. We've designed the billboards, we've done the photography, we're doing the messaging, you know, we're writing and, you know, we're doing all of that for free with volunteer time and labor and expertise. And we want them though to help us with printing and, you know, renting billboards and bus wraps and all of this stuff. And they're like, no. Now we're hoping that we can convince them, but their initial inclination is, number one, there's not enough vaccine. So why should we be trying to get more people to
They think there's not enough vaccine.
Well, there isn't. We have, at the moment, shortages, but the ramp up is sort of invisible. And we're like, we need this. We need to be planning this now so that the guy who reads it today is like, no way. And a month from now is like, maybe. And 2 months from now, he's like, okay, I'll sign up for an appointment. Like, that's sort of the arc I'm hoping for some of them.
But hold on real quick. But is your best guess that these commissioners, if you ask them, do you think that we should try and get every person we can to get vaccinated? Would they agree with that as an end goal?
So here's one of the weird things with messaging that has happened in this pandemic, which is that the behind the scenes stuff and the sort of back of house stuff has come to the front. And so what we're suffering with is the received wisdom that we should not be forcing anyone to get a vaccine. Like, that's, you know, we can't, that should go into the messaging, that the messaging is about persuasion. Unfortunately, when people hear the back of house messaging that we can't force anyone, they then extrapolate that and say, we also can't pressure them. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, we can't even do the messaging. We can't spend money on that because that would maybe make someone feel like they ought to get a vaccine. It's like, no, we want them to not be forced, but to feel like they ought to and have to sort of work a little bit, you know? And,
you know, my brain is very simple, actually. And I just think about sort of about six things. And one of them is Dasani water, which I'm pretty sure is just ionized
your
tap
next,
water.
Your next like sponsor or what?
Yeah, I hope so. Dasani water, I'm pretty sure, is not from a source like Evian or whatever. It's just ionized tap water. So we have a society where you have tap water, and we then have, we're marketing and capitalism are able to convince people to pay for a bottled version of what they already have. So it's weird to me that people think that we can't pressure people and persuade and convince them to get a vaccine when we can persuade them to pay for water that they already get.
That is brilliant. That's exactly right. Like, we do marketing and pressure campaigns for all sorts of things. And yet somehow this is touchy.
You just said I was brilliant. I just need to sit on that for a second.
Oh yeah, I love it. I think you're good, Jordy. I don't tell you how much I appreciate you often enough.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
Okay.
So I think this has been useful, but like, here's one thing I just want to throw out. Like, I'm coming back to like, if there are knobs and we can move them. So equity, high or low, maybe. I actually mostly heard from y'all that maybe the political context is not a factor, which I think is actually really an important, you know, let's just say that as a tentative outcome. Like, and I kind of agree with this. I don't think if we talk about the Republican Party and inter-party dynamics, there's not a scenario in which they've changed such that it affects the course of the pandemic, right? Like, the Republican Party going to do what the Republican Party going to do.
Okay, but I wanna just push back on that a second, because
please.
There's a difference between saying that the status quo isn't going to change and that there is no political effect. So like, there is a political effect and we're living in it. So like, the argument you seem to be making is that we're like, that's not going to change. So we can't, that's not a knob that we're able to adjust. Like, it might be a knob, but the handle part of it's off. It's just kind of stuck in the one position, and however much dynamism there is to the other knobs, like, we just kind of have to turn those ones and try to mitigate the political costs.
And it's huge that we flipped the biggest switch, right? Like, let us not ignore the January 20th
saying it doesn't matter. Okay. I'm saying that there's no heterogeneity in the future for what the Republican Party does that matters for any things we're talking about. So whatever its dynamic effect is with these other pieces, There's not a place where the Republic, our best guess is that, for example, like, let me throw out an option. The Republican Party splinters into a fascist party and a business party.
Sure.
I don't see that happening.
If they do that, they will have also splintered the left into a far left and a centrist left party. So it wouldn't spell the end of the, they would make sure that it had happened equally, and therefore it would continue to be a.
Okay, that's fascinating. I don't know why you say it would have to be that way. And I don't know if we have time to get into it now. But I can totally see one party fracturing and not the other. Cause you said they would fracture it as if the right is going to fracture the left.
Oh yeah. That work is underway.
I'm not sure you're in the same writer's room that I'm in. You're over in some other dystopian writer's room. I'm in this writer's room.
I am still like paying attention to online disinformation campaigns from Russia. Sorry.
No, that's
Okay. So
getting back to the knobs and the dials moment.
Yeah.
I think where that sort of metaphor model sort of breaks down for me, Jordy, and what you're saying is that just because it can't be influenced doesn't mean we can ignore the influence that it has. I think that's where like I'm a little hung up.
I'm not ignoring it. If our goal is to say, and let me take a quick crack at this. I mean, this is sort of a kind of a resting point for here. There's a scenario, and I'm going to call it co-opting Corona capitalism. There's a scenario where some of the things that we've talked about. So, for example, a couple of the factors. There is a sort of general disposition towards more solidarity thinking, right? Like we now have said everyone's going to get a vaccine. Can you imagine 2 years ago where we said we don't care about the cost, we don't care about unequal distribution, we're going to make sure everybody gets the flu vaccine this year, or whatever, or everybody's going to, you know, or everybody's going to have healthy vegetables. $14, I sort of see that as a cost per person. I don't know what that is, but if we put $14 per capita into healthy vegetables for every person in America, we would do a lot. But that was like unthinkable. Okay. So that's part of what, you know, we've got public-private partnerships around this vaccine technology and the development, all that. I don't know all of that. We've got some of the things you were talking about, Aaron, right? I've heard, you know, people saying people are more engaged than they've ever been. So we have a kind of maybe similar to the Depression and the Greatest Generation, a kind of political like awareness raising and around a kind of commonality. So all of that could lead to, like, in my mind, and I don't want to be naively hopeful, but hope is a strategy, right? We co-opted Corona capitalism and we have a new post-pandemic commonwealth. The other scenario is like the sort of slouching towards dystopia that we're already in. So like, I in my mind, I keep thinking about booster shots for vaccines. In a year or two, what if the political will to make sure that everybody gets a booster fades? And now it's not just that we have unequal, potentially inequitable distribution of vaccines. You know, we've left many people to the tender mercies of the privatized healthcare system, privatized health insurance system. And so the kind of like we thought we lived in an unequal society before the pandemic. We're going to move into where, and I think Sam's talked about this really well, the different bubbles people live in will be even more extremely different from each other. That's two very different scenarios. And just to finish my like rambling hypothesis, I don't know if the way I was talking about politics matters for whether we get to one or the other.
Well, we're already there, number one. Like the existing inequities have already been exacerbated. Mm-hmm. In the past year. And the reading of the American Rescue Plan, people may have listened in on the teletown hall for Fred Keller,
ooh,
our federal rep, last night. And he and most of the people who mashed the *3 button immediately upon calling in were basically on the terror about the American Rescue Plan being 9% COVID related and 91% not. At least one of the callers was like, did ask about one component, and which had to do with personal healthcare and nurses' aides, I think. And they were like, I don't know whether you think that's in the 9 or the 91, but it's really good. And, you know, but no one really got a chance to push back on this idea that 91% is not related to Corona. They have a very, right, they're drawing the perimeter of what is related to coronavirus, you know, to vaccination, you know, like, or, you know, they don't understand. They want to not include all of these other things, which are, you know, octopus-like connected.
Well, I mean, you know, this is the thing, is that the right wing social movement in America has decided that liberals and Democrats are an alien force. You know, we're the other. And so this is what this is about. Right. So what I'm saying is everything that Wolf did, even if he made mistakes, and I'm sure he did, it was about a nefarious agenda to crush them. And, you know, and this is all about their professional victimhood. And so this is the same thing. This bill, they're complaining about the co-opting Corona capitalism that I'm praising. They're saying, oh, look, it was being used to ram down your agenda to turn us into a, you know, an Islamic communist society. And I said that knowing the contradiction inherent in it.
I mean, right now, like yesterday, Wolf was saying, I know that we're supposed to expand vaccination, but we just don't know what to do yet. That is basically what he said. Like, he is like frozen. He is damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. He doesn't want to, you know, they did screw up. There were lots of things that have been screwed up, but also lots of things that have been exacerbated. And he can't tell which way to go next. And people aren't helping. Like, I know you didn't want to hear about it, but like, people jumping in ahead of the line in central PA are giving the state the impression that we still have vaccine uptake in the 1A group, and possibly we don't. It's unclear. And you would react differently if you had different data coming in, and we're messing up the data with people hopping the line and showing a sort of level of vaccine interest, still, you know, high level vaccine interest among 1A when it's actually what the beginning of 1B. And so that's muddling things for them, deciding, do we lower the age limit? Do we expand to 1B as originally targeted? Do we do it week by week? Do we do mass vaccination sites? Do we go with the small scale pharmacies? What do I want to see? First of all, I wanted to see more supply. So I'm happy about that. I also wanted to see clearer messaging. I am not happy about that at the federal or the state level. Still unhappy about that. And then I want to see the actual administration. Also not happy about that, right? Now, getting the supply to happen was the critical path, and that had to happen first. But everything else, we still need, I'm hoping that somewhere in the background, someone is doing messaging work and they just haven't unveiled it. I'm hoping someone is doing a sign up, right? They should just be taking our information from the people who want to be, and they rank them.
Okay, we can stop.
Okay.
I mean, vaccines is a thing. That's not my goal here. You know, my goal is like, can we start to think about what are different future paths? And going back to, I will say about critical path, which are the critical paths that matter now? And, since I'm the former educator, I'll grade us and say we get at least a B or a B plus, right? Like, equity is a thing that could be a knob that will move. The political context is not as simple as, you know, will Republican political leaders hop on or not? You know, I mean, we could revisit that. You know, a lot of the vaccine discussion that we did have, I think, was really important about hitting on several different things. You know, there's the creation of the supply. There's obviously the critical path of how it gets supplied. And I guess the other thing I would highlight is there is this factor for these scenarios, which is a generalized sense. I'm just going to keep calling it solidarity, a generalized sense of solidarity. Like, that is a thing that is there now that, I don't have a great way to measure it. And I'm a little bit, you know, as a trained social scientist, sometimes I'm a little bit like, I'm just kind of waving my hands with like anecdotal data, but you know, I'm not going to wait for a survey about, is there more or less solidarity? Like, it's there. I think, you know, as an organizer, we need to move on it. I just kind of want to, as kind of go around the horn, like, I'll just put it this way. Like, what is a topic that's sort of broadly about the pandemic that, you know, you yourself feel like doesn't get talked about enough, and you know, you think like, if we were going to revisit this is a topic we really need to focus on. Does that make sense? And I'll go first for myself, which is I think that the economic structure of the pharmaceutical industry matters, and especially this may have changed, but like, my general understanding was like, their ability to deliver new kinds of medicines has been shrinking for a long time. And so the large pharma are marketing entities that grow by buying smaller things. And I'm just interested if the way that public science has interacted with private development here with the mRNA platform, or if like, there's been other features here that will lead to some sort of radical change potentially in how the pharmaceutical industry is structured. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think the area that that I think is like just not discussed enough is that COVID, I think, is not unique. I think what's not discussed enough is the next pandemic. Mm-hmm. I actually think COVID didn't really create the problems that we're talking about. It just exacerbated them, right? It just highlighted that chronic underfunding of our public healthcare systems and the concentration of of healthcare and political power in corporate hands creates a social system that is unsustainable and cannot react to or handle, or is sustainable or cannot handle these sort of like compression moments. And COVID, you know, as like monumentally traumatic as COVID has been, you know, I think epidemiologists and folks smarter than me are saying, frankly, we're lucky it's not more communicable, right? Like they've been, you know, public health experts and epidemiologists have been talking for years and years and decades that like, this is somewhat inevitable. There's going to be a very serious global pandemic. And what I don't see people talking about is how we actually create a system that is both sustainable and people focused and care focused and able to take on the challenges that we foresee. And what I don't want to have happen is what the Republicans are trying to do here is like have all the funding and all the resources and all the change be entirely COVID related. And I think mm-hmm. the changes that we need, talking about equity, talking about democracy, talking about our economy, like across the board, it's really broken. And COVID made that clear. What I don't hear people talking about enough, and what I would want to like lift up and shout from the rooftops and talk to as many people as I possibly can, is like, look, you know, fundamentally, COVID is not the issue, right? The issue is a system that is incapable of, because of corporate interests and because of decades and decades of the erosion of our democracy, that is incapable of handling these sorts of crises moving forward.
I mean, a great way to amplify those things that you want to get out there, Aaron, is to start a podcast.
Well, I'm happy to be here today.
Okay. Sam, what's for you? What's the thing that's not talked about or
it's the psychology and the psychological factors that go into what Aaron's talking about. Like what are we terrified of? We're terrified of sharks, Ebola, child abduction.
I'm not terrified of sharks or Ebola or sharks with Ebola.
We, broadly speaking, like these have an outsized sort of impact on people's perceptions.
I'm terrified of squirrels bringing me hard-boiled eggs. That's what I'm terrified
spiders
of.
Spiders crawling out of my body.
Right. But here we are embedded in the middle of climate change, the COVID, this current pandemic, and like the long-term consequences of institutional racism. You know, those are things we are so bad at paying attention to, acknowledging, or doing anything about. Like, we can't. Like, we're like, Ebola, oh my God. You know, and Ebola is terrifying, right? Your insides melt, and that's gross. But, you know, what we're finding is 500,000. I mean, we're like, what? We're well over that. Like, me, Miss Numbers, I am not obsessing about the numbers anymore, but we're at this ridiculously high number of people that we have attributed to having died from this. And there are more people that we haven't yet attributed, or that we never will attribute in this country. And that is only this country. We can't deal with it. We have the trial of the man who killed George Floyd happening right now.
Are you not saying his name on purpose?
Yeah, of course not. Oh. In fact, I try to say the person who killed George Floyd. He is on trial right now. And, you know, everything about our system is like, these people were angry. It's like they were watching a person get killed. You know, like we can't, our structures are set up to almost prevent us from doing what we need to do. And even when we try to take things on, we know that, I mean, we all are anxious here. We're like, is that man going to get off? Right? We all watched him kill someone.
That's a whole, damn it, starting up new things.
Sorry.
But like, you know, I mean, what I hear you saying is it's Hollywood's fault. Like if the day after tomorrow, whatever, if all of the environmental disaster movies had been better, then people would have had the mental templates to better understand this. Like they're more scared of sharks and Sharknado than they are of climate change. You're not blaming Hollywood? Okay, that's
what I'm blaming our brains. Like Hollywood is just doing this, but yeah. Our brains are set up to deal with saber-toothed tigers and not to deal with the lake drying up.
See, that's fascinating because while they were worried about that, they exterminated. Thank you. They mass exterminated all the megafauna, right? Okay, so Sam, great. We can't fix our brains. We're screwed. Thank you. Nathan?
Great. So actually, it occurred to me that that's almost the inverse of something we talked about a long time ago. It was the one tweet, which bringing up tweets on a podcast, how original. But there was the one where
hashtag millennial.
I know it was this thread though, and we spent a long time, almost a whole episode, talking about it. And it was the woman who was saying that like everybody wants to be like a hero. They all want to believe that
they're
the pivotal point. They don't want to know that like we're actually accumulation.
We're good at crisis heroism and bad at you know, perpetual empathy
it was more like there was some healthcare terminology. It was like chronic empathy.
Right. We're good at sort of, yeah, momentary heroism and shitty at chronic empathy.
Yeah. And that's kind of, that's the inverse of this. Right. So I was thinking about that, but the thing that I think doesn't get talked about enough is just that our government really isn't as responsive as it could be. And it's really weird. Like, I like that we have some friction in the system because I think it prevents a lot of bad things from occurring. But when we're dealing with things that the needs change on a pretty consistent basis, we need a government that is more responsive. And I think that there are ways to do it where we don't just say the only person who is enabled to do this is the executive, right? Because that's what we end up doing with a lot of emergencies, where we just say we need one person making decisions, and that's fine and everything. But there's a lot of gray area in there where there is more room for cooperation. I just think that you need to have more people who are willing to do it. And then they can't like outsource their responsibility, because that's what ends up happening with a lot of legislators. But that's like my hobby horse. So I'll address that on future episodes.
I think the one thing I just want to lift up in everything that we said here, and I just want to be really clear about, is like, the failures in these systems is not a mistake, right? Like, that's the other factor here, right? This is deliberate, right? Pennsylvania has the 46th least funded Department of Health in the country. And that is not a mistake. That is, you know, 15, 20 years of Republicans cutting public health spending, right? Basically defunding our public health system. Cutting nurses, cutting caregivers, cutting programs, right? Cutting our welfare system.
Yeah, but now we have casinos.
I do enjoy a good game of poker from time to time.
Listen, I enjoy them much more when they're at somebody's house than in a... We've even privatized that, you know? Sort of socially mediated gambling is far more fun than commodified gambling.
And so it's also where, like, when you were talking a moment ago, Jordy, about, like, the political elements of all this, like... Maybe it's the perspective. It's like how I walk through the world and how I view the world. So like, this is my very personal perspective, but I actually think the political landscape is incredibly important, and it's where the rubber meets the road, particularly on policy here. And so like, it's also, I think, what has broken a lot of our systems, and not certainly not simply through our public health system or the facilities and the folks who are working there, but the deliberate strategic underfunding of public health and public supports, which is obviously tied up into institutional racism and misogyny, across the board, all of these, that intersectionality that Sam was talking about. But I would just sort of...
Collisionality,
thank you. Just sort of offer, though, that like, I'm actually hopeful. I really am. I really, really am. I actually think that... The new generation, the generation that has been like clipped by so much of this last year in loss of socialization and education and I believe are also developing an unprecedented level of communal empathy. And we have some momentum. I think those two combined really do give me hope. I think very much is dependent on what we do now, but in a way that also gives me hope that, like, I actually do think, like, we, like, literally the people listening to this podcast, the people talking on this podcast, like, we as, like, community members in central Pennsylvania, or if you're listening in Wisconsin or wherever that other place was.
Woodstock, right? Illinois.
Woodstock, Illinois.
Also, big shout out to our Israeli listeners. That's about
3%
of our audience.
I do think, like, what comes next and what the trajectory moving out of COVID becomes, like, we're part of driving that. And given that we have some momentum and we've been doing some pretty amazing things lately, and that I really think there is a broader collective consciousness that is about social responsibility, and that we have a generation that's going to think about social responsibility in a new way.
Can I just suggest, because that always feels very, like, guilt-ridden. I think it's interdependence. Don't you think it's interdependence? An awareness of our mutual interdependence?
So you.
Well, it doesn't have to be. Yeah, that is the UU.
I think it's a bit of both, frankly. I think interdependence is real. That's, like, where solidarity comes from. But that comes from a lived experience. And mm-hmm. I think we also need social responsibility, because I am not going to experience what a woman of color experiences. And so I can be an ally and I can show up in solidarity, but I think that requires a bit of social responsibility outside of my own experience.
Okay.
Well, but I would say that, like, the Heather McGee and sort of, you know, we all do better when we all do better, that is that interdependence and the understanding that, you know, vaccine equity helps everyone, mm-hmm. that, you know, combating economic inequity helps the economy, you know, as a whole. Those things are about interdependence. And I shouldn't just allude to the, you know, UU reference, because, you know, Bill McDonough, he was involved in a, you know, declaration of interdependence, I forget, like 25 years ago or something like that. And it was, you know, not independence. Independence is sort of a forerunner, but we also need to, you know, dedicate ourselves to interdependence.
Well, I'm on the road in my hotel room, and I think I just paid for another day to capture all of this great content. So I hope not. But this has been fantastic. I think what I've really taken away is I'm going to go write a script now called Ebola Carrying Shark Kidnappers, because that is going to sell.
It's happened to all of our very primal fears.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, squirrels are kind of terrifying. Did anybody see it? There was sort of news of the weird.
Saber-tooth NATO.
Oh. Mm-hmm. The
NATO?
Saber-tooth NATO, like shark NATO.
Oh. I was thinking of North American Treaty Organization, and I was really lost.
different NATO.
Different horror movie.
The only other thing that I wanted to say is, like Aaron was talking about, how there's much more of an appetite for action right now that we can take advantage of. And I know from being on a call with him a couple of weeks back, I guess, that like nurses of PA are organizing, trying to get people who have
So I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He said, if you can't take these twists and turns, man, I don't blame you. And I said, listen, I've traveled every road in Pennsylvania. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. I've crossed the valleys fair, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. Been to Millview, Rockview, Waterloo, Lackawanna, Fairview, Bellevue, Sweet Root, Susquehanna, Lewisburg, Stroudsburg, Illiesburg, Orbisonia, Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, Wellesburg, Robsonia, Mountaintop, Glen Rock, Flat Rock, Sunbury, St. Mary, Schick, Shanny, Big Shanny, Amadanny. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. I've crossed the valleys fair, man. Travel, I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Bellefonte, Southmont, Westmont, Wilmersdorf, Nordmont, Dormont, Lebanon, Hummelsworth, Cedar Springs, Bowling Springs, Chess Springs, Center Bridge, Centersport, Leesport, Williamsport, Brackenridge, Lumber City, Central City, Lake City, Clearfield, Westfield, Wentfield, Richfield, big deal. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. I've crossed the valley, spare, man.